The First Amendment is not this nation's most popular, but many people say it is the democracy's rock and its salvation. I'm Susan McInnes for Conversations. I hope you'll join me on this edition of Conversations. We'll be talking with journalist, jazz critic, fiction and nonfiction writer, and champion of the First Amendment, Nat Hentoff. Welcome, Mr. Hentoff. Thanks for joining us. Why do you suppose the First Amendment is not something that we celebrate daily, go into raptures over in this country?
Well, I think from the beginning of the Republic, there has been a fairly obvious sense among most people that while free speech is a nice thing to have, if you agree with it, or if you don't disagree too much with the speaker, once somebody says something hateful, hurting, offensive, racist, sexist, homophobic, that shouldn't be allowed, because that divides the country, and we never want to be divided except by ourselves. So you had, and it's a political situation too, in terms of, well, the First Amendment as part of the Bill of Rights was ratified in 1791. Only 7 years later, the Federalist President, John Adams, and the Federalist Congress passed the Alien and Sedition Acts, which said, among other things, that anyone who criticizes the president, who holds the Congress in contempt, as if that were even possible, would be put in jail. And sure enough, they put a number of editors and reporters in prison, and some lay people. President Adams was going into a small town in New Hampshire, I think, and he was preceded by a cannonade. And there was an elderly person in the town who had spent the morning at the local pub, and he heard the cannonade and said, "Oh, I wish they'd blown it up his ass." That was heard, and he was plunked right in the slammer. And, you know, we've had terrible violations of the First Amendment in the First World War. Gene Debs, the now revered socialist leader and labor leader, was put in prison for just saying that he'd oppose the war. That's all he said. And the McCarthy period. More recently, you had the President of the United States, that eminent libertarian, proposing and getting through the Supreme Court, actually, the Rust v. Sullivan gag rule, which was absolutely incredible. The fact that a physician was not able to give his professional opinion to a young woman or an older woman who came to these federally financed family planning clinics. They're mostly poor women. The physician is not allowed by this gag rule, which the Supreme Court said was okay, to even mention the word abortion. Then after a furor, they changed it a little and said the physician might say it, not very loudly, but the people that the women see most of, by far, the nurses and the counselors, they still can't say it. So the First Amendment, as you said, has never been anybody's favorite amendment.
There's another point of view to the civil libertarian point of view that was maybe best set by Justice Harry Blackmun when he said something to the effect of, after all, the First Amendment is just one amendment in the Constitution, saying essentially, let's get it off its pedestal. There are other guidelines.
As Justice Brennan would have answered him, it is only one amendment in the first ten and the others. But without it, we would not be able to do anything about violations not only to it, but all the others. If you want to protest capital punishment, let's say, if you want to protest cruel and unusual punishment, for example, the hitting of children in schools, they are the only Americans who now can legally be beaten. If you don't have a First Amendment right, or as black activists in the South found out in the 60s, if it weren't for a few federal judges like Frank Johnson, who upheld their First Amendment rights to demonstrate, then the civil rights movement would have been set back grievously. Nothing else works in this country if the First Amendment doesn't work.
This is Conversations, and we're talking today with Nat Hentoff. So you will know, I mentioned he is a journalist, a jazz critic, a defender of the First Amendment. He is one of the creators of the Village Voice, having worked for that newspaper as a writer 34 of its 37 years of its existence. He's also a regular writer for a columnist for the Washington Post and a staff writer for the New Yorker. His columns appear quarterly in The Progressive, also in a magazine I've just been introduced to, in Present Tense, and others. More about Nat Hentoff as we go on. This is Conversations. I know there are going to be some people in the audience who will be wondering and not wanting anyone to know they're wondering exactly what the First Amendment says. Can you throw it in a capsule for us?
First Amendment says Congress shall pass no law, and then later, much later, that was changed by the Supreme Court to say not only Congress but the individual states may not abridge freedom of speech or press, may not establish a religion, may not violate the free exercise of religion, and may not interfere with freedom of assembly and the right to petition peaceably for grievances. So that encompasses, really, among other things, it's the core of the right to conscience, which was a very hard thing in any civilization to establish, certainly in the colonies. I mean, in New York, my state, in the 18th century, a Catholic priest had to be out of town and out of the state by sundown, or he'd be in prison. In the Massachusetts Bay Colony, Quakers and other heretics were lucky if they could escape alive. People were whipped in Virginia for not going to church. So this was perhaps the hardest of all the rights to establish, which comes out of freedom of speech and expression and the like. I'll give you an example out of current. I'm a heretic on the left. I am pro-life. I'm a Jewish atheist, the most stiff-necked division of that branch. I have no theological baggage. I just read some biology, and I think there are two lives there. Anyway, the point is that in this Freedom of Choice Act that the pro-choice people are urging be passed, and it will be passed in both houses, it was originated by Don Edwards of California, who I've called the congressman from the Constitution. He's absolutely superb. Mm-hmm. First Amendment, Fourth Amendment. His subcommittee oversees the FBI, much to the FBI's disgust. But on abortion, he feels, like many people do, that these developing human beings have no rights at all. Neither do the people, for example, in the Freedom of Choice Act, there was an attempt to put in a conscience clause, straight out of the First Amendment. I've run into, over the years, a number of nurses particularly, and not all of them by any means are pro-life. But they hate to participate in second trimester abortions, because that's when you dismember the fetus. And there are about 44 states now that have conscience clauses. No hospital can force them to do that. This bill, if it's ever signed into law, and it will be if Clinton becomes president, this bill has no exception at all. And I find this rather odd. I talked to Kitty Colbert, you know, the ACLU lawyer who argued before the Supreme Court in Planned Parenthood versus Casey. And she said, well, I agree with you. I think there should be a conscience clause because of the First Amendment, and it should cut both ways, because there are some hospitals that do not perform abortions that penalize doctors who do in their private practice. I said, fine, we agree. Why doesn't the ACLU say something about that, which they have not yet? But that's an example of a First Amendment-based right of conscience that even the good people, the Don Edwardses, will not recognize because there's something more important. There's always something more important.
I want to turn us, I think I want, I'm going to come back to the question of abortion later in our full hour, but I want to turn us to the question of hate speech, because it is preoccupying the nation these days. There are, just to introduce briefly, speech codes in many, I think you said about 300 universities.
The last I heard from a man who spends a lot of his time collecting this information,
counting.
He's a professor at the University of Houston Law Center, there are at least 300 and probably more colleges and universities that either have codes explicitly punishing offensive, racist, sexist speech, which can lead to suspension or expulsion of a student. Never a faculty member, by the way. You talk about academic freedom, that's only for faculty. And some of them have them not as explicit codes, but as part of their regular rules of conduct. And there's a great similarity in most of them, particularly since the Federal District Court in Wisconsin and another one in Michigan threw out the University of Michigan and the University of Wisconsin codes as being too broad, too vague. So now most of those codes try to be narrow, and they say you can't punish anybody for epithets that demean someone, denigrate someone, offend someone because of their race, religion, sex, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And also because they want to conform to the Chaplinsky decision, which is a 50-year-old Supreme Court decision that has been in a closet somewhere at the court ever since.
This is fighting words, right?
Fighting words. Yeah. And how do you define a fighting words? An epithet that causes or tends to cause someone to punch you in the nose if you say it. It's a strange way for a college or university or anybody else to curtail speech, because you look at that equation. You say something, whether or not you intend it to be so worrisome that somebody will punch you. You say something, you get punched in the nose, you're guilty. So what's the message to the college community? How do we take care of offensive speech? We punch out the speaker. It's like Germany, when they had dueling.
The argument, or one of the arguments for a speech code, says that the playing field is patently unequal in this country, mm-hmm. for minorities, whether we're talking about women, a majority in numbers, but not in access to rights and responsibilities,
yeah.
African Americans, other people of minority racial groups, or people who are gay people who are out, who are public about their mm-hmm. orientation, that the playing field is not equal in this world. At least in a university, we should give people a comfortable space in which to study, where they don't feel accosted or attacked. You say no,
well,
not appropriate.
First of all, the underside of that is, you say that at least in a university, which means that students who engage in offensive speech, however that's defined, mm-hmm. and it's a very slippery way of getting at that sort of thing, they have then less rights of speech than people who don't go to college. That's your place of academic inquiry. Second of all, what do you do? The argument, and you're right, that is the key argument, and it's based on the 14th Amendment. The conflict is between the 14th Amendment, which guarantees equal protection under the laws, and that means in a college setting that blacks and gays and Jews and women and whatever, that they should feel part of the equal structure of the place, and if they're offended or wounded or hurt, then they're not protected by the 14th Amendment. And the civil libertarians, the few of us there are, say that's all very good and true, but once you start whittling away at the First Amendment, first of all, you're expecting good and decent people to decide which words under what circumstances are to be punished. But actually, the administrators of colleges who decide these things are very much like the people you meet at the Motor Vehicles Bureau. They're just going by the numbers. Much more important objection is that you want to find out, if you have any sense, as an administrator or as a student, you want to find out how much bigotry there is at the college. And if you can, who are the bigots? You suppress this speech, you drive it underground where it flourishes, and you don't know anything about what's going on, and you're not engaged, as you're supposed to be, in the process of education. The whole thing is a scam. It's a thing where the administrators, unfortunately encouraged vehemently by a lot of students who think that they're onto something here, the administrators are avoiding their job of educating. The students are producing nothing but censorship, which they're supposed to be opposed to. And the worst irony of all, and Nadine Strossen, who's the president of the ACLU, brought this up, I hadn't thought of it. She said, these are the very students who, with good reason, have no faith in the integrity or the ability of the administration, but they're saying, okay, we're going to give you the power to censor speech. And the rest of the argument against this is, you don't learn how to deal with bigotry by being protected by the administration. Malcolm X used to be very strong on this. We talked about it every once in a while. His concern for black students was that they learn how to demystify language, to look at those lousy, rotten epithets that are thrown at them, to dissect the people who do it, to learn language of their own that was much more powerful, so that they're not victims. The argument I hear all the time is, these students are victims of this offensive speech. Well, one of the things they ought to learn is how not to be victims. And you don't learn that by being protected.
I think there's truth and integrity in that. On the other hand, if I, as a woman, am sensibly self-restrained from walking down a dark street, even a lighted street, even on a campus, because I know how many women a day are raped in this country.
Ah, you're talking acts now.
Well, but how close is language to act? If someone follows me and calls me any one of a string of names that any one of our viewers or listeners can identify with immediately without me saying them, I have a reason to feel threatened. And I have even greater reason to restrain the exercise of my rights and responsibilities. So what would you say to me who has reason to cower in the first place?
If someone or some people, because these people often operate in gangs, not always, but if you're followed and nobody touches you, but you are hit with a fusillade of names, the names, as you say, we all know, but this being television, we're not supposed to say, if it's a pattern, if it goes on several times, and there was a case in California where a woman, a black student, used to walk across the campus every afternoon at 1 o'clock to go to a class. And some white louts would follow her and say terrible things. And they were punished correctly because a verbal pattern of harassment, as in Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which is about the workplace, that can be punished, just as a threat, a purely verbal threat, can be punished. If it's a one-time thing, that's a much more problematic thing. But even there, if it's a one-time thing and the verbal part is really awful and threatening, in other words...
This is what I'm going to do to you.
Yeah. If it's the usual kind of nonsense, you know, the how you look or what I like to do in bed and with you and that sort of thing, but if it's a threat, like I'm going to take you to bed or I'm going to rape you, then it's no longer protected speech.
Shows intent, malice.
Yeah, the words themselves make clear... Yeah. It's a threat, okay. And threats are not protected.
Nat Hentoff, if you're unfamiliar with his work, you may want to make yourself familiar. His autobiography, Boston Boy, tells a good deal about this fellow and his life. If you like jazz, his books are numerous and excellent. Among them, Jazz Is and The Jazz Life. Hear Me Talking to You and The Jazz Makers were co-written with Nat Shapiro. Another book just called Jazz, co-written with Albert McCarthy and four kids. Journey into Jazz. If you're looking to get your child introduced to it, it's a good way to do it. Susan McGinnis here with Conversations. I'm talking with Nat Hentoff. I want to move from speech to its companion and friend, which is thought.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that you've referred to the phrase thought police in this country. Casual, nothing written to any kind of guidelines or laws. But from both sides, it feels like America is restrained. In some circles, you don't talk positively about affirmative action or about abortion rights. In others, you don't talk about the opposite.
I have a book coming out about that. It's a manuscript is over 700 pages, which surprised me. It'll be out this October, I guess, and it's called something like Free Speech for Me, but not for Thee. And it's full of examples of just what you said. It's my theory that there may be four people in the whole United States who believe totally in free speech.
What do you think's happening? Is this? I guess I want to ask you, is this an unusual event, psychic event in the state of this country, or is it normal for America? And are we aware that it goes on?
I don't think we are aware because people on either side or sides, because depending on what the issue is, you have many different kinds of approaches. But if you feel strongly about something, you do not believe that the other side has the right to speak. You may not put it in that way, but you think they're kooks, they're liars, they're propagandists, so why give them the same First Amendment right that I have? Because it's worthless speech. I mean, you get some law professors who talk about the worth of speech, and they have their own scale about speech that if it's down on the lower scale, it hardly needs protecting at all. I am of the school, if that's the word for it, that all speech is valuable, including the most disgusting, whether it's Reverend Wildman giving a sermon on disgusting literature or Hustler magazine.
And it is valuable innately?
It's valuable because, and this is where some of the law professors and others would disagree, I think all speech conveys ideas. Mm-hmm. They may be disgusting ideas, but they're ideas. And also, and this is the defense part of it, well, one of the great, great defenders of free speech was Harold Washington, the mayor of Chicago. I found out about that because before he was mayor, he was a member of the Subcommittee on Civil and Constitutional Rights in Congress, Don Edwards being the chair. And Don would send me transcripts of various debates they had. And Washington was even more fierce in defending First Amendment rights than Edwards. He got to be mayor of Chicago, the first black mayor of Chicago. He was immediately surrounded by some of the worst racist aldermen in the history of the country, who were doing everything they could to undermine him. And he was really besieged. In the middle of this, they had a thing where every week the local public radio station, financed by the city of Chicago, would have a poet of the week. One week they had a black poet who made Mr. Farrakhan sound like Billy Graham. I mean, he hated all whites, Jews especially, but all whites. He was really non-discriminatory in that respect. And the calls came in, get rid of this guy, and Washington wouldn't do it. And the word he said, and I got this from his press agent at the time, was, you know, if I scratch one word, where do I stop? Huh. And that to me is the essence of the whole business. If you start censoring terrible, disgusting speech, who decides to do that, and where do they stop?
But what happens when we begin to self-select or others select for us? A quick tumbling of examples. Noam Chomsky has written dozens, literally dozens of books. He is irritated with and takes the United States government to task for years of its life on domestic and foreign issues. He's published, but he's not reviewed almost anywhere. Publishers Weekly gives him an inch and a half. Louis Farrakhan is not invited to lunch anymore. He's not a speaker
frequently. He was invited to the
frequently.
Washington. First of all, he makes a lot of the college campuses, but it's true, he's invited by the black student unions.
Only.
But
nobody else wants
to
hear
him. A year and a half ago, he was given a treatment in the Washington Post as if he were the president of some European country. 2.5 pages of news, a full transcript of the interview. Now, Farrakhan is taken quite seriously. Chomsky, you're right. The thing about Chomsky that I find interesting is that he gets through. Anyway, I was at Amherst last week, and they told me that Chomsky was sort of a visiting lecturer there briefly. He gave 3 lectures. The halls were jammed for each one. I mean, Noam has worked hard to get a reputation, as it were. But, you know, this has been true. Tom Paine, if it hadn't been for broadsides being easily published, would have had a hard time. I don't know what you can do about that. You can't compel people to publish people. But I think Chomsky is an example of somebody who, because he has, first of all, utter conviction in his own views, to say the least, and utter determination, he's the stubbornest man I've ever met, he has gotten through. What do you do with people who don't have those qualities? What can you do? You can't legislate it.
So it's kind of a luck of the draw question, or a luck
of the
ego.
It's a luck of the character.
Yeah.
Luck
yeah.
of the ego, right.
Yeah. I guess this brings me to the big question in my mind, which is, what is the state of debate in this country? How healthy is it?
Well, Thomas Jefferson used to say that the only way this peculiar institution, which is how he described constitutional democracy, would work, was if the people were informed. And who was going to inform them? The press. Now, he grew to hate the press. At the end of his life, he wrote a letter to somebody in France saying that the only newspaper he read now was the Richmond Advertiser, and only for the advertisements, because he didn't trust anything else. But he still believed that the press should not be censored, because however imperfect, to say the least, the information was, how else are people going to be informed? Now, what we have now, we have most people getting their news from television. More and more people do not read a daily newspaper. I ask students when I go around the country, do you read papers? And very few of them read a daily paper. So you've got the people that Thomas Jefferson was relying on are now Tom Brokaw and Peter Jennings and Dan Rather. I don't think most people watch C-SPAN, which I find the best channel there is. So you've got a paucity to begin with of just plain information. I mean, how much can you cram into 23 minutes? And then you've got a lack, and I guess you've always had it, but it's a lack of really good, hard reporting on issues that people really ought to know about. You know, some people used to say, Abe Rosenthal used to say, when he was running the New York Times, that a newspaper is only a mirror of the events. Well, that's nonsense. A good newspaper does create news in the sense that they go after news that people don't know anything about. would not be interested in if you told them about it until they saw what it is.
And might prefer not to hear it.
Mm-hmm. Now, the press has now been going through an orgy of self-flagellation about how they handled the Jennifer Flowers business and the draft business with Clinton. I think both of those were legitimate stories, even though they came first from the Globe, a tabloid supermarket newspaper. I think adultery is an important element in the character of a president. I think it shows disrespect for women, among other things. Perhaps more important, it shows a stunning lack of judgment that he could put himself in a position where he gets taped. He never denies the taped. It reminds me of Jack Kennedy when the press was had a tacit agreement not to print this sort of stuff. I mean, we all knew that when Kennedy checked into the Carlyle Hotel in New York, he was not getting a string of dignitaries of foreign countries visiting him. And Kennedy wound up sleeping with Sam Giancana's mistress, the head of the Chicago mob. Mm-hmm. I think the people had a right to know that, but we didn't print that then. We do now, and we're embarrassed at the fact that we're doing it. That having been said, the press is very late in getting at Clinton's record in Arkansas. This guy was in cahoots with the leading polluter of the streams. There are all kinds of things going on there. I mean, his record as governor is abysmal, abysmal. People don't know that. Why doesn't the press go after it? I don't know.
This is Conversations. We're talking today with Nat Hentoff. A little more information about Nat Hentoff. In his nonfiction books, The New Equality and Our Children Are Dying, fairly early works, The First Freedom, perhaps his best-known book, subtitled The Tumultuous History of Free Speech in America. I'm Susan McGinnis, and you're watching and listening to Conversations. This is Nat Hentoff, my guest.
I'd like to
on the other side.
One other thing to
sure.
that, though.
Sure, all right.
Because I found this perhaps the most dismaying thing ever since I've been a journalist, since the Battle of Bull Run. About 2.5 weeks ago, the Supreme Court came down with a decision out of DeKalb County, Georgia. It was a school desegregation case. The court unanimously, there were three concurring opinions, which were worried opinions, but they still joined the opinion. The court said, in effect, that Brown versus Board of Education, which said that all segregated public education is inherently unequal and unconstitutional, the court said in this case, Freeman versus Pitts, that Brown versus Board of Education is dead. It is no longer the law of the land. It did something worse. It went back to Plessy versus Ferguson, which was the 19th century case that Brown versus Board of Education overruled. Plessy said, separate but equal is constitutional. This Kennedy, Anthony Kennedy, wrote the majority decision in which he said, look, you got racially unbalanced schools. If they're due to demographics, the way people move and where they live, there's nothing we can do about that. There's no constitutional violation. You've got 66% of black students, public school students in the United States, going to segregated schools. Some go to schools that are 90 to 100% black. That is apartheid. There's no other way to describe it. The Supreme Court has just said, that's okay. There's nothing you can do about it. This was a one-day story.
But I was going to say, where's the uproar?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Usually the Supreme Court, I mean, you will see, even though these were just oral arguments, after the Pennsylvania case on abortion, you'll see follow-up stories on Sunday and next week. This was a one-day story in the Times and the Washington Post and the Wires, nothing on Sunday, which indicates to me that the largely white press, the practically all-white people who make the decisions, the editors, the managing editors, have in the back of their minds already concluded that there's nothing to be done about segregation in the schools, and that this was just part of the court whittling down Brown. But they didn't just whittle it down. They destroyed it. And how are you going to get people to understand what's going on without the press saying something?
Well, and it's a damned if you do and damned if you don't. Or maybe it's a, more properly a catch-22. If the people don't know what's going on, the people can't
sure
rise up. If the press doesn't tell them what's going on, the people won't know to...
See, I would think, and I have no idea whether this is true or not, if I were a managing editor, I'd get somebody on the Hill to find out. I could make some calls myself, come to think of it. But I would like to know how many black congressmen and congresswomen paid any attention in anything but a cursory way to that decision. Because if there's going to be any protest, it should be led, probably will be led by them. It ain't going to be led by many white people.
Well, but the protests in the 50s that resulted in any kind of civil rights equity in this country didn't come from Congress. They didn't come from any administration at first. They came from people in Selma, Alabama, from ministers.
It's interesting, you know, you get people out on the streets now for pro-choice, for gay rights, but not for civil rights. And it was back in the 50s that Mike Harrington, a man I admired a lot, he was the head of the Democratic Socialists and all that. Mike said, and he was very pro-choice, but he said to a meeting of the Americans for Democratic Action, and they must have thought he had gone out of his mind, he said, you know, one of the key movements today, because it gets people out on the street, is the pro-life movement. And that's a test. That's a test of how the First Amendment and constitutional democracy works. When the courts aren't doing what they're supposed to do, when Congress isn't doing it, you got to get out on the streets. But in terms of black rights, that's gone now. At least it's gone for the time being.
Perhaps suspended.
Depends. You need leadership, and that's another problem. You don't have Whitney Young, you don't have Roy Wilkins, you don't have Martin Luther King, you don't have Bayard Rustin.
Malcolm X on
Malcolm
his
X.
Side.
See, Malcolm, if he had not been killed, he would have, I think, been the preeminent leader, because when he got back from Mecca, he had decided, he wrote a lot of people, including me, a postcard on the way. He had decided that while he was going to continue to organize blacks by themselves, because you needed that kind of self-power, he now thought it was possible and desirable to work with whites who were not racist. And he had the power, the presence, and the intelligence to really come through. We don't have that in any white or black leadership today. That's another problem. You know, you put down the idea of leadership because it's a democracy and the people speak. You still need leaders. We wouldn't have had a constitution without James Madison.
I want a couple more questions on the press, and then I want to change subjects here. You have said the most useful function of the press is to get the public, or at least parts of it, you say, to ask why. You wrote that in a piece about why cameras should be allowed to witness and pass on the witness of executions. Talk to me about why you said that about that subject and why it applies to others.
Well, we are the only so-called Western, industrial, civilized society which says it's okay for the state to commit murder. And people sort of accept that. Many people accept it enthusiastically. But few people have actually seen an execution. And after the one out in California a couple of days ago, I heard on some radio station a reporter saying, that's it, that's the last one I'm going to see. I think it's important for people to know what's being done in their name when somebody is being executed. Now, apparently this stuff is hardly foolproof. There was an execution in the state of Arkansas when Bill Clinton was running in the primaries in New Hampshire. Clinton went down to Arkansas to preside over the execution to show that although he was a Democrat, boy, he was not tough, he was not soft on crime. The guy they were executing was a man who had killed two people. The last one was a cop. After he killed the cop, this guy put a gun to his head and blew out half his brains. He was not anywhere near aware of anything at that point. Whether today is tomorrow or yesterday, that didn't bother Clinton. Anyway, by the time they found the right vein, he was a big man, by the time they found the right vein to kill him, almost an hour had taken place. That, to me, aside from everything else, would be punishment under the Eighth Amendment that's cruel and unusual. Nobody put up any kind of a fuss. I would wish people had seen that. There are some people like Tony Lewis, whom I admire and read all the time, but Tony doesn't think you should put executions on television because it would further coarsen the people. Now, aside from that being a rather elitist notion, somebody once said, is it okay if people who watch an execution on television bring quiche instead of beer? It makes no sense to me to say that. if we want it, if the majority of the people want it, then they ought to see what it is they want, because they don't know what it is. I'm for, here I'm practically all alone, except for some of the most ardent pro-lifers. I think they should show the results of second trimester abortions. It's all very abstract now, pro-life, pro-choice. Look, this is what happens.
And the logic in both cases is we get the thing from all sides out there so we can stand around, look at it, and decide as a nation whether we want this or whether we should keep continuing on
right.
with the debate.
William Burroughs had a line in one of his books about we ought to see the naked lunch at the end of the fork. And we try to avoid that. It's a natural human aversion. But that's why I'm all in favor of showing on television. I mean, people can always turn it off. It's not like 1984. They're not compelled to watch it.
Okay, now to quite the other side of people should be able to see. There are people in this country who would actively protect their and our children from what they think of and what you have termed as the infectious permissiveness now rampant in the nation. People who want to take Huckleberry Finn off the shelves from another perspective because it uses the word nigger.
Mm-hmm.
People who want Catcher in the Rye off the shelves and have for the last 30 years as far as I know because of its sexuality. People who want the Impressions reading series for elementary students taken away
sure.
somewhere and put in a dark room.
Because it's witchcraft.
Because it's satanic.
Yeah.
Now, these people are not by and large what we would think of as crazy people.
No.
They are people of conviction, and they are saying, I don't want my children exposed to this.
I'm glad you said that, because some of the people who are against this censorship, as am I, tend to demonize and stigmatize and generalize about them. And I've met a lot of them because I've covered a lot of stories. And they are very sincere in their convictions. Their problem, from my point of view, not their point of view, is that they're very generous in their desire to protect children. They want to protect not only their own children, but everybody else in the school. Now, most schools, and certainly most libraries, have a policy, or most school libraries. If a parent objects that strongly, then give the child an alternative book.
That child.
That child. Many parents will say that's not good enough. Then they go through the review policy. You know, you have to say why you object to it, and they have a committee of teachers and administrators and all that sort of thing, and then they may go to court. And there's nothing you can do about the process. The only concern I have is that some principals, PALS, are so anxious to avoid trouble, they're the ones who hide in their office every day anyway, that they will yield to a protest and go, and I know I've heard this from librarians throughout the country, they'll go to the librarian and say, put it on the shelf, or take it out of the basic reading of the curriculum. Huckleberry Finn is a particularly interesting example. It is a novel that I think is the most important American novel ever written. It's a rite of passage, and it shows how a boy, Huck, who was reared in an utterly racist society, finds out through the friendship of one man, Jim, what it is to be a decent, honest adult, to the point where they're on the river. And Huck has been taught, it has been driven into him, that if he ever runs into a runaway slave, if he doesn't return that slave to the owner, he, Huck, will go to hell. There's just no way out of it. There are no dispensations. And he's agonizing on the river. And he finally says, all right, damn it, I'll go to hell. And of course, he doesn't turn Jim in. And there are so many parts of that. However, on the other hand, as you pointed out, and as one black opponent of the book has noted, nigger is mentioned at least 200 times. That was Twain's way of showing how bigoted people were. Nonetheless, it can be a shock to a black child. And it really hit me, well, it hurt me a number of times, but the first time was, I was talking in a library during Banned Books Week in Indiana, and there were several reporters there. When they all left, one black reporter, a young woman in her 20s, said, you know, I was introduced to Huck Finn in Nebraska when I was going to middle school, and I was the only black student. Mm-hmm. And I have never been able to read that book. The teacher, she said, just gave it to us. No background, no context, no nothing. So I have come to recognize and to urge that that's a book, in fact, many books, but that's a book that certainly ought to be taught by a teacher who knows something about the book.
Context.
About the background, about Mark Twain, etc. After that, a child can still, it seems to me, decide not to read it. They had a big hassle in Plano, Texas.
Plano.
Is it? That's Plano.
Plano, Texas,
right.
Yeah.
I never knew which one I got right.
Right.
And there was a young black student who said, I'm not going to read this book. It's a terrible book. But she was curious. And she read it, one chapter, another chapter, and she said, you know, very interesting book. And that's part of learning. That, again, that you demystify the language. You have nigger repeated 200 times, but then you realize why he did that. And that's why nigger is a weapon, not against you, but against the people who are racist.
Can we teach youngsters about the First Amendment, about free expression, free speech, without offering up such things as Catcher in the Rye, Huck Finn?
Well, kids are pretty quick to understand what's going on. If they're in a school where books are thrown out or put on the back list or that sort of thing, they know what's going on. So if you tell them about this being a country based on freedom of speech and expression, they know you're a hypocrite. The kids around the country, I spend some time in middle schools, and I've just begun to work in elementary schools. Fifth graders are the smartest people I've come across in years. Most of them, smart as they are, and by the way, the stereotyping that goes on. I was in Pennsylvania for a week, rural schools and semi-rural schools, and the teacher in charge would tell me, "Now you're going this afternoon to this school. They don't go on to college, they go into work and they've refrigerator mechanics, so don't expect much." They were the quickest kids I ran across. And that's that terrible self-fulfilling prophecy that goes on in schools. Anyway, most of the kids, bright as they are, have no real knowledge of what this First Amendment thing is like, because they haven't been taught it well, and they haven't learned that it's possible to use it. The exceptions are the kids who have worked on high school newspapers, and the battles they have had with their principals, and some of those battles have gone to court, have made them, I think, lifetime First Amendment advocates.
Well, it has in your case. It wasn't high school, but it was Northeastern University.
Yeah, I was the editor of the Northeastern News, and we didn't think we should have just a paper that wrote about how bad the food in the lunchroom was. So we went outside. We broke a lot of stories about anti-Semitism in the city, which was then epidemic.
It's in Boston.
Yeah, in Boston. And we began to question the members of the Board of Trustees to find out why they're on the board. I mean, what do they know about education? Or were they there just because they raised money? And that was it. The president, who would never deal with us directly, got his hatchet man to tell us we either stop that and indeed concentrate on the food in the lunchroom or leave. So we left. Naturally, there was one scab who didn't leave, and he became editor of the paper. The interesting part to me was, years later, somebody from the paper called me about something, and I said, well, you could look it up in the bound volumes, you know, that we did. He said they weren't there anymore. Huh. It was like Stalin. Now, but later they put it back.
People who know about Nat Hentoff will know what that series of events did to you, created in your life. But those who don't won't. What happened because of the lightning? What did you decide about?
Well, you know, I had never been, again, at Northeastern and even at Boston Latin School, the best and the oldest school in the country. We never learned much of anything about First Amendment, Fourth Amendment, anything like that. But once this hit me, that we had been thrown out of a job that we loved, we hated losing that paper, and we'd been thrown out because we were doing what journalists are supposed to do, I became very interested in the First Amendment, even though it didn't apply to Northeastern, which was a private school. And then at the same time, I was very much involved in jazz, as I still am. And to me, there was a direct link between the free expression of the music and the musicians. I mean, I'd rather hang out to this day with jazz musicians than anybody else, because they are free. Mm. They don't euphemize. They tell you what's on their mind. And I still think one of them would make a good president.
One question from the other side. There would be many people in the audience and many audiences who would say to you, well, wait a minute, Nat, you're talking about high school students when you're talking mostly about school newspapers. Don't they need the judgment of an advisor to help them hone and craft their stories?
The problem of that is the advisor who is supposed to help them judge is usually, whether he's tenured or not, or she's tenured or not, a teacher who knows damn well that if he or she lets a story go that will annoy the principal of the school board, he or she's going to get fired. They don't need that kind of advice. There are some advisors who are great, who say, you go ahead and print. Well, I'll look at what you do to see if maybe you may have violated libel law. But that's all I'm going to do. And those advisors usually get kicked out in time. I mean, the Hazelwood case, which came before the Supreme Court and almost destroyed the Magna Carta of children's First Amendment rights in high school newspapers. In 69, the Tinker case said that children have constitutional rights.
The Tinker case, the case that a young girl wore a black armband.
A young girl and her brother.
And a friend of theirs.
And a friend in Des Moines during the Vietnam War. Mary Beth Tinker was her name.
She was 13.
Yeah.
Her friend was 16.
And she is now working, last I heard, in a hospital taking care of soldiers who were severely disabled in the Vietnam War. Anyway, they came to school. They were Quakers. Their parents were Quakers. They were Quakers. And they were protesting the war symbolically. They didn't say, the banners didn't say anything. And the principals of the two schools involved did what principals usually do. They hastily panicked and said, you can't come into school until you throw take the banners off. Went off to the Supreme Court, and in a great decision by Abe Fortas, 7-2 decision, he was a loss to the court. He would have been a great Chief Justice. Fortas said that the Constitution does not stop at the schoolhouse door, that you have the right of free expression, which later courts interpreted to mean newspapers too, provided you do not obstruct the functioning of the school and interfere with the rights of any other student in the school. Hazelwood came along. You talk about the capacity of kids. These were high school children, high school students in St. Louis. And in the newspaper that got them into trouble, they ran, among other things, a series on classmates, without mentioning their names, who had gotten pregnant and who had regretted it, and who wanted to give advice to various students. And they ran a series on children of divorced parents and the effects that that had on their lives. These are two subjects that are of great interest to the constituency of that paper. And I read the stories, and they were really first-class stories, not sensationalized or anything. Principal took them both out. Didn't even tell them he was taking them out. They got the paper on a Wednesday or whatever day. There's an empty space in there. So they go to the Supreme Court. They would have lost anyway, maybe, but they had one of the worst lawyers in the history of the Western world. The kids were good kids. They were loyal to this woman because she had helped them in St. Louis, but she didn't have the faintest idea of the case. And the court decided in the Hazelwood case that despite these, by me, splendid stories, the rule now was that a principal could censor anything, a play, a newspaper, anything that did not meet his or her standards of educational merit in the school. Now, what kind of standard is that? You make it up every morning as you shave. Some states since then, under prodding from students and student advocates, have said, and a state can do this, a state can say the court sets limits, sets the bottom of rights, but a state can give people more rights. And they have, in a sense, annulled Hazelwood. But that's only a few states.
Once again, this is Conversations, and we're talking with Nat Hentoff. If you haven't read any of his novels, I have recently, kind of fun. Blues for Charlie Darwin came out in 1982. The Man from Internal Affairs in 1985. They're both about a fellow named Noah Green and his experiences in the police department in Boston, right?
No, in New York.
That's right, NYPD. Call for the Keeper came out in 1966, and a book called Onwards, also a novel by Nat Hentoff. We're talking with Nat Hentoff today about the First Amendment, and you're listening to Conversations. I don't know whether you say this about yourself. I read it in A Christian magazine, I can't think of its title now, that was talking about you as someone who is pro-life but otherwise frowned a bit, it seemed to me, at your life and convictions. This magazine called you a proud member of the Order of Stiff-Necked Jewish Atheists. Along that line, you would, I understand, object to the presence of "In God We Trust" on coins,
right,
to chaplains in Congress.
You know, Thomas Jefferson, during his two terms, refused to allow a chaplain inside Congress.
What did he say? It was like having an alien?
That was another story. During the Constitutional Convention,
yes.
Things were getting very tense, and Benjamin Franklin said to the fellas, there were no women, I think we might be able to calm things down if we get a minister in. And Alexander Hamilton looked at him and said, "We don't need any foreign aid."
That's right.
And you'll notice the Constitution, not the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution has not a word about God. Nowhere is there a word about God in the Constitution.
Why would you pull all these out? The coins, the creche in front of the city hall, school prayer, moments of silence in the classroom, chaplains in Congress.
Because, and this is Justice O'Connor's version or interpretation of the Establishment Clause, this is more to the point in terms of creches and crosses during Christmas and other kinds of Christian holidays, although I'd like to see them all go. O'Connor says that you violate the Establishment Clause, that is, Congress shall not establish a religion, which means Congress shall not prefer any or all religions. You violate that if you make people feel excluded. When I was a kid in Boston, we had crosses and creches everywhere, in all the public buildings.
Sure.
And I said to my parents, "This is a Christian country." And it was, as far as I was concerned. So this is also a country where you have the free exercise of religion. Take your creches and crosses and menorahs and put them in your synagogues and churches, put them on your own front lawns, your own private property. Why put them in a public place where people will feel excluded if they see them?
I think because people say this is a Christian nation.
But it's not. That's why I said there is no God, let alone Christ, in the Constitution. There was an oral argument before the Supreme Court in December. It looked as if four members of the court, led by Anthony Kennedy, wanted to undermine O'Connor and set up a new standard, and they thought they might have a fifth member to do that. What Kennedy wants to do is say you can do what you like. You put a creche on a courthouse, a public courthouse, or in a school, provided that the effect of that is not to coerce people of another religion into joining your own religion or something. And they thought they had the case. The case was a rabbi having been invited in Providence to deliver whatever rabbis deliver, same thing ministers deliver, at a middle school commencement. And the rabbi thanked God for what these fine children had done. Sitting in the audience is a Jewish father who is an atheist, and who says, "Well, God has nothing to do with this. Why are you bringing God into a public school ceremony?" The case went to court, went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And arguing for the school board was a man whom I know very well, Charles Chuck Cooper, used to be in Mises' Justice Department, very bright guy, but he got carried away that day. I think he blew the case. What happened was that O'Connor said to him, Justice O'Connor, "A state has a state flower, a state stone. Would anything prevent a state from adopting a state religion?" And Cooper said, "No." The justices went aghast. And then Scalia said, "What if instead of 'In God We Trust' on the coins," which is a generic religious kind of thing, "we said 'In Jesus Christ We Trust'?"
And he said, "Sure."
And he said, "Well, that's not politically possible, but there's nothing wrong with it." And then even Kennedy said, "You're telling us that at a public school graduation, which is a very important part of a child's life, you're saying the child, if the child is offended or if the parents are offended by the presence of a rabbi or a priest, they can stay home at an important part of her life?" Now again, I've learned this the hard way. You're never quite sure that these questions at oral argument are going to wind up in the right decision, but I'm hopeful. I don't see why. I told this I just talked to a whole bunch of Christian lawyers in Chicago, and I said, "Why are you pushing this stuff? Nobody prevents you from exercising your religion any way you want to. Why, to use the vernacular, do you want to put it in our face?"
Well, now, for a man who doesn't want to put religion in people's faces, you've also said that a young girl, and this was, I think, a Supreme Court case, has a right to invite kids to study the Bible on school grounds after school. Why is that different?
Because it's after school. First of all, that was the Mergens case,
right,
in which a student at a high school in Nebraska said, look, there are all kinds of clubs that meet either before school or after school with the permission of the school. It's called a limited public forum, and that's where the First Amendment kicks in. If you have a Merle Haggard club and a French club and all that sort of thing, why not have a religious club? It's not the school's imprimatur, it's the student. It's initiated by the students. It seems to me that's not an establishment clause, because the state is not involved in it except to provide the room, which is the argument of the ACLU. The state provides the room. Sometimes the ACLU can be very picky. And the Supreme Court, I think, unanimously went along with the Mergens case.
I'm going to ask you too big of a question with 3 minutes only remaining, but I'll ask it anyway. With the Supreme Court becoming more and more conservative, the administration of the country, if it remains the same or similar, being more and more conservative, is there a bastion of civil liberties in this country, a bastion of civil rights anywhere?
The main hope, and Justice Brennan said this in a Harvard Law Review article in the early 1970s, he was very annoyed at his brothers, didn't have a sister yet, because of what they were doing to the Fourth Amendment particularly. Just search and seizure was becoming too easy for the cops to do. And there were other things. And he said, look, remember, we have state courts and we have state constitutions. Some of the state constitutions provide greater authority and strength to constitutional rights, our federal rights, in the state way than does the Supreme Court. Oregon, for example, 5 years ago, outlawed obscenity. Not saying you can't have obscenity, say you can't be busted for obscenity. Because their state constitution says you can't be penalized for freedom of expression. And the most conservative judge on the court said, that means we're not going to arrest anybody for obscenity. A court can do that. Not all courts are that way, and not all state constitutions are that strong, but you can work on the legislature, maybe. But at least you have some hope in some states. In New York State, we've just had 2 search and seizure cases overthrown by the state court that would have been approved by the United States Supreme Court. And the state court said, this is our constitution. And Brennan said the trick is, when you write that kind of decision in a state court, make sure you make no references at all to federal statutes or federal Bill of Rights protections, because then Rehnquist will see them and go glunk and review them. But if you leave it to the states, you can do that. It's, you know, it's uncertain. It's not going to work everywhere else. But it's a hard future otherwise, because, I mean, I must say, even though I will not vote for Bill Clinton, as much as I abhor George Bush and the people he puts on the court. But I'm sure that if Clinton were put in, he could put in worse justices. So if he's elected, you'll have some surcease. Although the youngest people on the court are the ones who are going to be most difficult to move on Bill of Rights stuff for generations. Certainly Clarence Thomas, who was a big disappointment to me. If Clinton is not elected, and I think the Democrats should have done better, you're going to get Bush for 4 more years, but then you've got their dilemma. If they put up Quayle, I could beat Quayle. Nobody would put me on the ticket because I'm pro-life, but otherwise, I think the Democrats will change the court somewhat.
Nat Hentoff for president. Nat Hentoff, thanks a lot. It's been a fascinating hour.
Well, I enjoyed it. Good questions.
Good. I'm Susan McInnes. This is Conversations. We've spent an hour with Nat Hentoff, and I hope you'll join me again next week.